generation dwells here. And then we're moving by the pack, so we moving them. And even if you don't, then you do, cause you cool with them. They be like, I only went to school with them. Let's
get it. Welcome to Color Correction, a Jesus-y podcast about race and faith from the perspective of an Asian guy, a black girl, and a white guy, too. I'm Andrew. I'm Asian American. I use he, him pronouns.
And my name is Bethany. I am black and I use she, her pronouns.
And I'm Chris. I'm white and I use he, him pronouns.
And we are here today with Mark Charles. And Mark, I'm going to let you introduce yourself.
Well, thank you very much, Andrew. Let me start by just introducing myself traditionally. So, Yat E, Mark Charles Yanishia, Sin Bake Dene Nishlin, Doto Higlini Bachachin. In our Navajo culture, when we introduce ourselves, we always give our four clans. We're matrilineal as a people, and our identities come from our mother's mother. My mother's mother is American of Dutch heritage, and that's why I say Tsin Bake Dene. Loosely translated, that means I'm from the Wooden Shoe people. My second clan, my father's mother, is Toa Higlini, which is the waters that flow together. My third clan, my mother's father, is also Tsin Bake Dene. And my fourth clan, my father's father, is Toda Chitney, and that's the Bitterwater clan. It's one of the original clans of our Navajo people. I also want to acknowledge I moved with my family from the Navajo Nation. I'm a dual citizen of the United States and the Navajo Nation. And I moved from the Navajo Nation to what we call it Washington or Washington, D.C. And these are the lands of the Piscataway. We've been here about 10 years. But the Piscataway are the hosts of these lands. They're the ones who have been living here for hundreds, even thousands of years. So I want to honor them as the hosts of the land where I'm living. Yes. I want to thank them for their stewardship of these lands. And I just want to state how humble I am to be living and working and raising my family here on their lands.
Thank you so much for that beautiful introduction. So normally, we start our podcast off by talking about, by doing different things, including talking about whatever we, addressing whatever we wanted to talk to about last time. But I figured we just kind of jump straight into the conversation. And we'd like to get to know each other. Mark, we were chatting about this earlier, and we're kind of curious about this. In terms of being aware of both of your whole family, of both sides of your family, the Navajo and the Dutch American. Was this an awareness you had to develop? Was it something that you always, that you feel like you always had? What was the process for that?
I mean, yes and no. My father, right? My father is Dene, Navajo. My mother is white, American of Dutch heritage. I grew up, you know, when they got married soon after biracial marriage just became legal, you know, and so this was back in the 60s when they got married. They were one of the first to jump in line after it became legal. And I always knew I was, there were two worlds out there, but I live largely within the white world. Right. I tell people frequently I was raised a white evangelical. My grandparents on my father's side were both boarding school survivors. And so the faith that was forced upon them was the faith that said you have to give up your language, you have to give up your culture, you have to become like white Americans in order to be loved by God. And that's what they did. I mean, that's how they survived the boarding school. And so they worked as, my grandfather worked as a translator for the early missionaries. And they lived within that world. And it was my mother's church, the Christian Reformed Church, that ran some of the boarding schools or ran one of the boarding schools on our reservation. And so they were obviously preaching that same gospel that my grandparents inherited, not inherited, but that they was given to them, that was forced upon them. And so that's very much the world I grew up in. Like I knew my father and the Navajo culture was its own thing. But I didn't grow up with hardly any of that. My grandparents didn't teach the language to my father because, again, they gave that up and they didn't want to pass that on. And so my father didn't know the language to speak it to me. Mm. So I wasn't raised speaking Navajo or knowing any of the ceremonies or any of the creation story or anything like that. I grew up very separate from that. It was not until college I went back and really began to start investigating. What does it mean that I'm Navajo? What is that? What impact does that have on my faith? And that's been the journey I've been on, not only back in college, but all the way up through my entire adult life, is trying to understand what does it mean that I'm Navajo and American. I'm a dual citizen of mm-hmm. of the United States and the Navajo Nation. This year, 2024, is the 100th anniversary of the Indian Citizenship Act. It was 100 years ago that Indians were made citizens of the United States. American Indians were made citizens of the United States. Mm-hmm. But that didn't take away our citizenship in our native nations. And so it's only been in the past several years I began to really emphasize, yeah, I'm a dual citizen. And I need to respect both of the nations that I'm a citizen of. So there's a lot of people who will say, well, you're half, right? You're half American, or you're half white, and you're half Navajo. And that's the way blood quantum works, which is the way the American Indian race was set up. I'm not half, right? I can't find the half of me that's Navajo and the half of me that's Dutch American. So I say I'm both. I am American of Dutch heritage, and I am Navajo. And I've gone through great lengths, especially in my adult life, to identify with both sides of that, of me, of those two communities. And I've worked very hard to raise my children in both of those worlds, to understand both of those worlds as well.
Yeah. What were some of the messages that you were given about your identity and your Navajo identity from your father growing up?
Well, again, I mean, this was what was so interesting, is because, right, my grandpa, how can I even say this? I'm writing a new book right now. It's called Decolonizing Faith. And the intro into that book is going to, I'll tell you the story. I heard it from a friend of mine, and his name is Ray Miniakon. He is Aboriginal from Australia. I met Ray about 20, 25 years ago as part of the World Christian Gathering on Indigenous Peoples, and he is doing tremendous work of kind of looking at the history of his people with colonial nations and with Christianity and faith traditions, and he's really looking at theological questions, and he's doing some great works. He works with NAITS a lot, the North American Institute of Indigenous Theological Studies. And he was at Calvin Seminary. Now, I have a long partnership with Calvin Seminary. I've been working with them for about 12, even 15 years, maybe. Mm. And once a year, they have a worship symposium in Grand Rapids. And I speak at this worship symposium nearly every year. I'm there every year. I'm attending, and most frequently I'm speaking there. But last year I wasn't speaking. I was just at the conference, but my friend Ray was there. And in his presentation was about Aboriginal people and Christianity. And their story there is very similar to the story of Native Americans with the Christian faith here in North America on Turtle Island. And he laid it out very articulately. He was very clear. He was very honest about what happened and the violence and the way it was forced upon them and everything else. And at the end of the session, he did a Q&A. And he got the question that almost all of us get whenever we talk about our faith publicly as Indigenous or as Native peoples, which is, someone said to him, Ray, your people have such a horrible history. The church has done such horrible things to your people. Why are you a Christian? Why would you follow this faith that tried to destroy your people? Now, we all have our answers to that question, right? I usually tell people, well, my grandparents were in the boarding school. They survived the boarding school, and then they went on to work for the missionaries. My grandfather even helped translate the Bible into the Navajo language. Right. And I will tell that story about my grandparents. And it's almost a redeeming story about how the evils of the history were overcome. And my grandparents went on to do some good work, even within the church. And Ray, when he was asked, why are you a Christian? His answer was very blunt and very honest. He said, because that's who colonized us. He said, if we had been colonized. If we had been colonized by Muslims, I'd be a Muslim. If we're colonized by Hindus, I'd be a Hindu. If we're colonized by Buddhists, I'd be a Buddhist.
Wow.
He said, that's who forced the faith upon us. He said, but today, I am interrogating my faith because I want to find out if this faith acknowledges my full humanity as an Aboriginal man.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, my jaw was dropping to the floor when he said this. I was in the front row, and I was riveted by what he was saying. And I spent the weekend with him, and I asked him later. I said, "Ray, why did you use the word interrogate? Why did you use that word and not examine or investigate or even try to learn?" And he said, "Because those words are way too passive." He said, "I am putting my faith on trial." Free of the auspices of Western missionaries, I am trying to understand, does this faith tradition acknowledge my humanity as an Aboriginal man?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I realized, right, that's what I was doing when I wrote my book, On Selling Truth. That's what I've been doing since I got to college and I began to explore more of what it meant to be Native as well as to be a Christian. That's why I co-founded the conference with InterVarsity and Campus Crusade, or now called CRU, called Would Jesus Eat Fry Bread, right? I mean, I was trying to understand what does this faith add to and what does it take away from my humanity as a Navajo man?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so the moment he said that, I'm writing a new book called Decolonizing Faith. And the moment he shared about what he's a Christian because that's who put a gun to his head. I mean, that's not what he said, but that's what he meant. You know, they're the ones who forced it upon us. I said that is the introduction to my book. That story is the introduction to my book. This book, Decolonizing Faith, it's a part two of On Selling Truth. And if On Selling Truth looks at how the church misused the scriptures,
mm-hmm.
to justify things like enslavement and broken treaties and genocide. So we critiqued what the U.S. did to African Americans and to Native Americans. We critiqued what the American church did, but we didn't critique the command in Deuteronomy where God told Israel to kill everybody in Canaan, right? Leave no animal, no man, no woman, no child left alive. We didn't critique that. Well, the second book is critiquing that. The second book is looking at how do the scriptures, the Christian scriptures, lend themselves to a violent, vindictive, nationalistic, and colonial worldview. Yeah. Not being misused, but being read the way they were written.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And I can tell you this journey of trying to understand this, I mean that it's mind-boggling. It's hard.
Yeah, I'm going through this. And you know what? I would love to talk about that. In fact, maybe we can talk about that instead, because I loved Unsettling Truths. Unsettling Truths is a great book.
It
lays out the doctrine of discovery as kind of this foundational text, foundational myth that created white supremacy and has led us to where we are now. But I honestly, hearing you say this, I'm kind of more interested right now in coming to you as an elder, because I think I can say the exact same thing. I'm a Christian because missionaries showed up in Taiwan, mm-hmm. and there were economic incentives for my great 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 grandparents to convert.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
they said shut your black ass up and be a Christian. You know,
mm-hmm. So to some extent, we're Christians here because a gun was placed against our head.
Right.
And we're all, and hearing you say that, you know, my spirit is resonating within me. I'm the same thing. How can I be a Christian? And is Christianity useful to me as this type of person? Mark, what have you found?
Well, I mean, we could be here for 5 hours. I mean, I have so many resources out there. Let me give you a few resources first, okay? So I've been preaching a sermon for the past 2 years. It's called Radical Inclusivity. In this sermon, I look at where Gentiles, because that's not only who I am and who most of you, probably all of you are, but that's who white people are, right? We're Gentiles.
Yeah. Yeah.
We are not part of the Jewish tradition. And so I started looking at where do Gentiles get written into the gospel story? And I'll just give you the 5-minute elevator version of this elevator summary of this, you know, where we as evangelicals, white Christians, are people raised in white Christianity or influenced by Christianity, we were taught to read the scriptures, the gospels, let me say that, through a Jewish versus Samaritan lens. So the Samaritans, they were kind of the half-breeds. They married outside the faith. They didn't worship in the temple. They worshiped on a mountain. They were living in sin because they weren't keeping the law. And it was probably because of their sin that the people of Israel were under the oppression of the Roman Empire. And so the Jewish people had a lot of problems with the Samaritans. They would avoid Samaria. They wouldn't welcome Samaritans into their fellowship, right? They were very separate from the Samaritans. And when you read the story of Jesus, the stories of Jesus through a Jewish Samaritan lens, he is radically inclusive, right? He walks through Samaria intentionally. He heals Samaritans. He goes back to their villages. He even makes Samaritans heroes in one of his parables.
Yeah.
He's also radically inclusive of anyone who's on the fringes of Jewish society, right? He touches mm-hmm. the leper. He heals women who work as prostitutes. He hangs out with tax collectors who are working for the Romans, right? He identifies and eats and drinks with people who are known as sinners. I mean, he is radically inclusive of anyone remotely associated with Judaism. But he's much, much different with Gentiles. There's only 3 stories in the Gospels of Jesus interacting at depth with Gentiles. You have Cornelius, the Roman centurion,
mm-hmm.
who asked Jesus to heal his servant. Jesus goes towards his house. He's almost there. And the centurion, who's there to keep the peace between Jews and Romans, knows that if a prominent rabbi comes into his home, there's not going to be peace in the community. So he tells Jesus, hey, I know how this works. I have servants who work for me. I say one to go and he goes. The other come and he comes. He says, you don't have to come into my house. You can do this remotely. Let's fire up our Zoom, right? And we can do this right here. And Jesus stops. He says, wow, your faith has blown me away. And then he heals the guy remotely and goes on his way.
The first televangelism.
Now, what's striking about that is anytime Jesus is impressed with a Samaritan or Jewish person's faith, he goes over the top.
He does.
He touches the leper. He listens to the whole story of the bleeding woman. He goes back to the house with Zacchaeus, right? He goes back to the village with the Samaritan woman. Whenever he sees someone's faith active, he doesn't just heal. He goes beyond that.
Mm-hmm.
But he doesn't do that with the centurion. He even says he's amazed by his faith, but he just heals and then goes on his way.
Hmm.
Then we have the Canaanite woman. Right. And if you've ever been in church, this is probably the most dissatisfying sermon you've ever heard in your life, because we all make Jesus look good in these sermons, right? About mm-hmm. the Canaanite woman. This is a woman who comes, her daughter has a demon, and she goes to the disciples, say, I want my daughter healed. They send her away. She comes back, gets all the way to Jesus, says, I want you to heal my daughter. He says, I didn't come for you. I came for Jewish people. She doesn't give up. She says, I want you to heal my daughter. And Jesus says, why would I give to the dogs what was meant for the children?
Which was crazy.
And she doesn't stop.
Yeah.
She says, you're right. In your scenario, in your worldview, I am a dog, but even the dogs eat the scraps.
Mm-hmm.
And Jesus responds and says, oh my gosh, you got it, right? You understand your position. Here's a bone. And he healed her daughter remotely, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then we have the demoniac, this guy who has a legion of demons. Jesus goes across the sea, meets the guy. He's living out in the tombs. Jesus heals him. The guy is sitting in his right mind in front of Jesus as he's getting up to go back over across the sea again. And the guy is begging Jesus, let me follow you. And Jesus says, no.
Mm-hmm.
So there's your 3 stories. Never goes into Cornelius' house. Tells the woman, I didn't come for you. When she says, yes, you're right, I am a dog. He doesn't correct her. He heals her, but doesn't correct her and doesn't do anything else. And then he tells the demoniac, no, you can't follow me. Right?
Yeah.
Very troubling when you consider word. So if any of us, including Chris, had met Jesus back in the first century and asked for a healing or asked to follow him, he would have either said no, or he would have made absolutely sure we understood our place in line, mm-hmm. which was at mm-hmm. the end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Very troubling. So where do we get included? Well, many people say Acts 2 is where we get included, right? Acts 2, this is where the Holy Spirit comes, and there's all of these people in Jerusalem, and we have the birth of the Acts 2 community. And that is true. That does happen. But that story is prefaced. It says in Acts 2, there were at that time Jews from every nation. Mm-hmm. Everyone in the Acts 2 community was a proselyte. All the men were circumcised. Everyone went to synagogue. They all ate kosher. Everyone followed the laws of the temple. They yeah. all worshiped in Hebrew. They were all culturally Jewish. I mean, this is the American church, right? This is, they all spoke the same language mm-hmm. and has, they made different colors, shades of skin, but they were all assimilated to the same culture. So Acts 2 isn't this radically inclusive story. It's not until you get to Acts 10, right? In Acts 10, we're introduced to a guy named Cornelius, and all we know about him is he's a Roman centurion. He loves God, whatever that means, mm-hmm. and he cares for the poor. That's all we know about him. He's told in the vision to call for Peter. Peter's up on a rooftop praying, and he sees this vision, right? This blanket's let down with all these animals on them, many of them unclean. And now Peter was with Jesus in Mark chapter 5. I think it's Mark chapter 5, where Jesus declares all foods were clean, right? Peter was there. But in Acts 10, he sees this blanket. He's told to kill and eat. And he definitively says, never, Lord, I've never eaten anything unclean. We might have said that stuff was clean, but we never ate it. And it's true. Read the Gospels. There is no story of Jesus ever eating unclean food with Gentiles. It doesn't happen. Peter sees this vision three times. Cornelius' people come. He's intrigued enough to go home with Cornelius. He gets to his house, and he doesn't say, oh, that's right, Jesus did this. I remember he went into the centurion's home, because Jesus never did that. So he right. gets there, he walks in, he says, I'm not supposed to be here. You're a Gentile, I'm a Jew, I'm not supposed to associate with you. Tell me why I'm here. Cornelius tells him the story about the angel. Peter starts preaching. As he's preaching, he sees the exact same spirit that the disciples, that the Jewish people got in Acts 2, now falling on uncircumcised Gentiles. Mm-hmm. And he says to the circumcised believers who are with him, he says, there's nothing now to prevent me from baptizing these people. Right? That's mm-hmm. the first time you see uncircumcised, unassimilated people being brought into the church and treated as family. And this is mind-boggling, right? Because we're told, right? So we have two theologies about Jesus. Most Christians, 90% of the churches, 90% of Christians, if you ask them, when are God and people reconciled? At what point does reconciliation happen in the Bible between God and people? Most Christians will tell you the same thing Paul will tell you. At the cross, right? The cross is where the temple curtain tears in two. The cross is where, right now, there's healing and reconciliation between God and people. Paul, who's the apostle to the Gentile, he doesn't preach the teachings of Jesus. He doesn't preach the Old Testament. He preaches what? He preaches the cross over and over and over again. The cross, the cross, the cross. Every time you take communion, right? What are we talking about? We're talking about the reconciliation between God and people at the cross. And so most Christians have a theology that says we are reconciled to God at the cross, but we teach Jesus like that reconciliation happened at the birth. You see, Jesus, 99.9% of Jesus' ministry took place before the cross.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus came to keep not the moral code of 2024 perfectly. He came to keep the Old Testament law perfectly. And Old Testament law required that Jews and Gentiles be separate. Now, when Jesus was teaching his disciples, right, when he was comforting them, he said, hey, I'm going to go away. And that's actually better for you because once I leave, I can send you my spirit. And my spirit will dwell within you. And the spirit of God will enable you to do even greater things than I've done.
Mm-hmm.
We often think that's hyperbole. Well, what Peter does in Acts 10 is greater than anything Jesus ever did, which is he baptizes mm-hmm. uncircumcised Gentiles
Interesting.
Into the yeah. church.
Yeah.
So when we ask, the church asks today, what would Jesus do? They're asking the wrong question. If we use Jesus as our model for inclusivity, that's the wrong model because that model is pre-reconciliation.
Yeah.
Mm. Now, and I'm going to pick on you, Chris, okay? Because you're the white guy here. If Chris wants...
That's why we keep him around. Sorry, Chris.
If Chris wants to have the heresy that says Jesus loves him, even though he's not a Jew and he's not a proselyte, right? He has to do one of two things. He either has to become a Jew or a proselyte, or he has to make Jesus look like him. What did white America do?
They made Jesus.
They made Jesus white, which means they're now in Jesus' in-group. It also means they can now treat the rest of us the same way Jesus treated Gentiles, and they're not sinning.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because that's what Jesus did.
Yeah.
Jesus did a lot of things really, really, really well, but radical inclusivity was not one of them.
Mm-hmm.
He held Gentiles at arm's bay, as was required of him by the law.
Hmm.
And he told his disciples, after me, the Spirit of God is going to come, and the Spirit of God is going to do something even greater than this, which you have to be ready for, which is what happens in Acts 10.
Yeah. This is a hard teaching.
How many churches are you getting chased out of for this, Mark?
Let me tell you this. I started wrestling with this passage in 2020, okay? It took me a year and a half to get to the point where I could preach it. Because I will be honest with you, I was pissed at Jesus. Because my entire life I've imagined myself following Jesus.
Yeah.
And when I realized he would not have let me follow him, he wouldn't have come into my home. He wouldn't have eaten a meal with me.
He definitely would have called me a dog.
I was pissed. Mm-hmm. And I remember one day, I'm going to say this like it was a conversation, even though it wasn't. Okay. I was talking to Jesus at the time. I was talking to God. God, how dare you let me know? How dare you let me believe that I could follow Jesus?
Mm-hmm.
How dare you tell me that?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer I got was, I never told you that. That's what the missionaries told you.
Yeah.
Again, if they can put themselves in Jesus' in-group, then they can treat me the same way Jesus treated Gentiles, and they're not sinning.
Mm-hmm.
And it took me a year and a half to wrestle through all of that. Until I got to the point where I could actually teach it.
Mm-hmm.
And since then, over the last 2 years, I get asked to preach a lot. Every time I'm asked to preach, we talk about the liturgy. We talk about where they are in their teaching series. And I always give them a few sermons I could preach that might fit in or just might be something new that they could hear. I always give that sermon, Acts 10, Radical Inclusivity, as one of my options. every church but one over the past 2 years has asked me to preach that sermon. And nobody has kicked me out yet.
Oh, good.
Well, ultimately, what you're saying, the implication of what you're saying is that those white missionaries are just as excluded or on the margins from Jesus' original ministry as any of us are, as those Gentiles were. What I imagine is the power of that sermon is that it kind of, it forces us all to reimagine our posture in relation to Jesus.
We've talked about this before. Remember, I've brought up that story about Jesus calling that woman a dog maybe 2 years ago? That story has bothered me for years, particularly as a Black woman. I don't know if we talked about it on the podcast. We might have just talked about it.
Oh, we definitely did.
We did. And we also talked about it in our cell group, Chris. But particularly as a Black woman, that story has always rubbed me the wrong way. Because I could imagine a man speaking to me like that. That's why I piped in. He would have definitely called me a dog. And I think what I have landed at is, can I be okay with a savior that was imperfect? And I think I can.
So again, what I, and I say this in my sermons, right? When you get to that point, right? So the, again, the Canaanite woman, that's the sermon everybody hates to preach, but or hates to hear, because we all, like everyone who preaches that, makes Jesus look good, right?
And when I preach it now, in what way do you hear people make Jesus look good in that scenario?
Oh, he was testing the woman. You didn't see the wink in his eye. I mean, he was still loving her, right? It all makes him look good.
He was really saying, "That's my dog." Right.
He was trying to to get her to like press him, or you know, right. I mean, I just say no. Jesus held the ethnocentric views of his time. That's what he was doing.
That's all he knew.
So I mean, this is actually that story that got me going down this whole route.
Yeah,
I was literally praying and saying, God, how do I relate to you? That prayer came out of my mouth, and the first thing that came into my mind was the story of the Canaanite woman. I was running for president at the time, and I was telling people on my campaign, if you think the foundations of this nation, the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, were meant to include everybody, I was telling people on the campaign trail that I want you to get into a diverse group of people and read those documents out loud. I said, you will be shocked and embarrassed at how quickly those documents turn racist, sexist, and white supremacist. Right? President Biden loves to misquote the Declaration of Independence. Right? He loves to say, we hold these truths to be self-evident that all men and women are created equal.
But it doesn't say that.
That's not what it says. Sentiment, right? I don't disagree with you, Joe, but that's not what it says.
Yeah.
It says all men. Just because a white landowning male misquotes it doesn't fix it. So I tell people, if we don't acknowledge what the document says, we're never going to be able to fix it. And so as I'm thinking this, as I'm reading the story about Jesus, and I've even preached sermons making Jesus look good in that service, in that story. And so I said, okay, I have to acknowledge what Jesus is doing here, which is he is holding the ethnocentric views of his time.
Yeah.
Once you allow the scripture to say that, that story makes perfect sense, right? It makes perfect sense if you're not trying to protect Jesus. But once you let the story say what it says, now you have a theological problem on your hands, because is Jesus sinning? Is he racist or ethnocentric, right? This completely blows up our theology of Jesus.
Yep.
Yeah, definitely.
And so again, this is where it's like, yeah, that's because we were given that theology by the dominant culture, who is using that theology to continue to oppress the people that they see as the other.
Yeah.
The dominant culture also what wants to convince us that the way it was is the way that it is. The idea, what you just said, Mark, the idea that theology or the Constitution can be fixed. There are a lot of people that for who would bristle at that idea. You know, you can't fix Jesus. You can't fix the Bible. The Constitution doesn't need to be fixed. It's inspired. The hard thing for us as people for whom these tools, whether we're talking about Christianity or the American government, these tools were not written for us. I guess the question for us is whether we can, are these tools still useful to us?
Mm-hmm. Well, see, that I think, so I would say, yeah, I'm not trying to fix the scriptures, mm-hmm. but I'm trying to fix a problem, right? So it's been 2,000 years since Jesus walked this earth, lived, died, was crucified, and raised from the dead, right? It's been 2,000 years. Not only does the world still struggle to acknowledge everybody's humanity, but the church refuses to acknowledge everybody's humanity.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We have a problem. And so what I'm saying is that I'm not trying to fix the scriptures. I'm trying to fix the problem, which is why can we not acknowledge everybody's humanity? And the answer is, it's because we're following the wrong model. We're asking what would Jesus do instead of asking what would the Holy Spirit do?
Mm-hmm.
Right? If you go on into Acts 11 and then later, right? So in Acts 11, the disciples hear what Peter did with Cornelius, and they're outraged. How dare you eat with Gentiles? Peter says, well, hold on, let me tell you the story. He tells him the story. The disciples are like, holy crap, even Gentiles are included in the salvation that leads to life. And so they start including Gentiles. Paul and Silas start including Gentiles. And now they have chaos in the church, right? They have people eating differently. They have people with different moral codes. I mean, things are just chaotic. So much that they call the Council of Jerusalem. They come together for the Council of Jerusalem, and they're arguing back and forth. And the argument that wins the day is when Peter stands up and tells the story of what happened with Cornelius.
Mm-hmm.
And then Paul and Silas stand up and confirm that with more stories of what they see God doing among the Gentiles. Mm-hmm. Now, let's fast forward back to 2023. My church, the Christian Reformed Church, is having our annual synodical meetings, okay? And they are debating the inclusion of LGBTQ and how do we interact with that community within our church.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very challenging debate. And the rule of the floor is you are not allowed to tell stories. What? My denomination literally said, we don't give a crap what the Holy Spirit's doing. We have our written theology of these old dead white men, and we're not changing anything. You may not tell your story on the synod floor.
Wow.
Oh, man.
Mm-hmm.
So this is, right? So again, the challenge is we're following the wrong model. Jesus is not the model for radical inclusion.
Mm-hmm.
The Holy Spirit's the model. The Holy Spirit came because of what Jesus did, but Jesus is not the model.
Scripture itself acknowledges that the disciples in the church will surpass Jesus, and we ignore that.
Often.
Yeah.
So but interesting.
I tell that story, okay? I tell that story. That so that's the first chapter of the book.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first chapter of the book.
Great. Amazing.
We're just working our way through.
Uh-huh.
We tell through that the story. Whole 45 minutes, and you said that's the first chapter.
So just give me a second here. I'll do this very quickly. So that's the first chapter.
No, I'm not rushing you. I'm laughing at that.
We'll spend as much time as you'd like to spend.
Yeah, no, we're like, okay. Keep going. Okay. Keep going. We're okay.
I tell that story, okay? Because then I start going through Genesis. And if I don't, and I'm going to say this is going to sound heretical, if I don't dethrone Jesus first, right? If I don't break that dam first, once I start critiquing the Old Testament, the only thing Christians are going to say is, yeah, but Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's all they're going to say. And so I have to dethrone that idol first. So that when I critique the rest of the book, they won't have an excuse not to listen.
Mm-hmm.
Now, again, yeah. We could spend hours here going through these other chapters, but let me just give you a synopsis, all right? So, in the Torah, we have the introduction and the story of God, right? And God's character and God's people. God starts as creator, is identified later as the God of Abraham, the God of a man, later becomes the God of Israel, and then in 1 Samuel, which is outside the Torah, Samuel is coming to God because the people are asking for a king. And Samuel's lamenting. They reject me as their prophet and they want a king. And God says to Samuel, they're not rejecting you as the prophet. They're rejecting me as the king. So we have God being identified as creator, as the God of Abraham, as the God of Israel. And ultimately, God is identifying God's self as king. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, as you go through that story, and as you get further away from creator and closer to king, the more violent, the more vindictive, and the more nationalistic God becomes. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Just, we'll go through Genesis really quickly, right? So we start with creator, Adam and Eve. Adam and Eve sin. God punishes them, kicks them out of the garden, but provides for them, gives them clothes, anything a good parent would do, right? I'm not abandoning you, but you can't live here anymore, but I'm still going to take care of you, gives them clothes. Cain and Abel sin. One brother kills the other. God punishes, sends the brother out, but puts a mark on him, right? I'm still going to protect you. Then, later in Genesis, we have Noah. And in Noah, God gets troubling because God sees the sin of creation and says, screw it, I'm going to kill everybody, right? That's not the nature of a creator, nor is that the nature of a good parent. But that's what God does.
Yeah.
Later,
giant tantrum.
God introduces God's self to Abraham. And he is testing Abraham. And wants to know if Abraham is going to love God more than Abraham's new child, his son. And so he asks Abraham to kill his son. Abraham's willing to do it. God stops him, but he's willing to do it. Then we also have the story of Sodom and Gomorrah. And the Sodom and Gomorrah story is troubling on so many levels. I could preach a whole sermon just on this story. I won't go into it all here, but I'm going to have a whole chapter on Sodom and Gomorrah and how we need to decolonize Sunday school, because the way we teach the story in Sunday school is, it's terrifying what we mm-hmm. do with that story. But God, again, sees the sin of Sodom and Gomorrah and says, screw it, I'm going to kill everybody. Then after Abraham, we have Jacob and then Israel. Now we have the God of Israel. God's the God of a nation. Now God takes Egypt, the Israel out of Egypt by killing the firstborn of all the Egyptians. Again, that's troubling. Gets on top of Mount Sinai, is giving Moses the Ten Commandments. The people are getting tired of waiting, and so they ask Aaron to make an idol. He makes a golden calf. They worship the calf. God sees them worshiping the calf and says to Moses, depart from me because my people are worshiping another God and I'm going to kill them all. Abraham begs for God not to kill him, but he doesn't appeal to the value of God's creation. He appeals to God's ego. He doesn't say, look at this valuable creation, the people who you've made, how can you destroy them? He says, if you destroy them, the world who saw you bring them out of Egypt with a heavy hand will think it was with evil intent because they're going to see you destroy them in the wilderness. He appeals to God's ego. And terrifyingly enough, God relents and repents and does not bring on the destruction of Israel as he had commanded, as he had planned. Then we get to Canaan. And now God, who has been so far content to do all the killing by God, now God says to the Israelites, now I want you to kill everybody. And they do. Let's even go back to the story of Noah's Ark, right? After this flood where God destroys the entire world. Do you remember what the rainbow symbolized? Anyone remember?
God's promise not to do it again.
Not to do it by flood
by water.
Again.
Not to do it by... So imagine, all right, and I'm going to describe... this is just a trigger warning. I'm going to describe some violence here.
Right.
Imagine if you have an abusive parent who comes into a room, grabs a baseball bat, and just beats the crap out of their children with the bat. Just beats them. Kills several of them. As the parent's walking out of the room, they put a pretty picture over the door and says, this picture is to remind me never to beat you with a bat again. Is that at all comforting?
No.
No. It's
no,
not.
No, it's not.
Right? So let's expand this now to the current situation in Gaza, okay? We have this war in Gaza. We have three participants in this war. We have Hamas, we have Israel, and we have the United States. All three of these nations have nationalized their religions, right? Hamas has nationalized Islam. Israel has nationalized Judaism. And we've nationalized Christianity. All three of these religions are Abrahamic religions. They all see the Torah as scripture, right? They all have this narrative of God moving from creator to king. And as God moves further from creator, gets closer to the king, God becomes more violent, more vindictive, more genocidal, and more nationalistic. We like to talk about how different we are as a nation from these other nations.
Mm-hmm.
The problem in Gaza is we're all the same.
Yeah.
We all have nationalized our Abrahamic faith, our version of our Abrahamic faith, and we are using that faith to justify unheard of terror and violence and nationalistic destruction in the name of our God.
So the Abrahamic faiths have in our shared foundational scriptures a God who is genocidal. Our Christian faith has in the Gospels a Messiah who is ethnocentric. Our country has at its heart a founding document based on a dehumanizing colonial idea called the Doctrine of Discovery. Is everything just... What do we do with this? What do we do with this, Mark?
Can I add like one?
Yeah, go
please
for it,
do.
Chris.
Sprinkle in something here. The thing I remember about the first time I heard you talk, and subsequently, like what you've written quite a bit about, is this idea of conciliation versus the standard Christian talking point of reconciliation. And I'm sitting here listening. I'm sitting here listening to this. And I feel like this, like while this feels like it's tearing apart so many of the things we hold true, I actually feel like it goes a long way to this idea you've held onto. And I don't know if you still held onto, but when you've espoused about conciliation, I feel like this is a very good path toward that end, because it resets a very important series of stages for everyone to come to a shared conclusion about what we believe and what we've held as a belief in error on all fronts, who Jesus is, how he fits into the arc of this Abrahamic faith that we draw our traditions from and we draw our stories from and our stories of Jesus from. And ultimately, who we are in the story.
Yeah. So let me say two things. The purpose of the second book is to cause a crisis of faith in the church. That's the point of the book. I don't want to get into a debate with theologians or even pastors for that matter. I'm writing this book for the people sitting in the pews. And I want them to listen to me frame these stories and say, yeah, you're right. We never talk about these things. We never wrestle with these things. And therefore, we believe things about God that the scriptures never state, or that are just flat out untrue, or we believe in a God we don't really want to believe in because that God's horrifying, right? And so we never have this debate, right? I'll just go back to Sodom and Gomorrah. We didn't even talk about that. But if you read that story, okay, right? First of all, we say Lot was righteous, and that's why God saved him. Lot was not righteous, right? When the angels came and said, we want to have sex with these men when they're with him in the house, he says, no, don't do this to these men. And I'm going to describe some violence here. He says, take my daughters. They're virgin, right? He pimps out his daughters.
Yeah.
Lot is not righteous. When they're fleeing the city, Lot's wife turns around to look back on the city she's leaving, and she gets turned into a pillar of salt. So the God of Abraham is a God who is more concerned with a woman who looks back than a man who pimps out his daughters. That is deeply, deeply troubling.
Yeah.
And we never talk about that.
It's really so uncomfortable to talk about it.
That's the first point I make is I'm trying to cause a crisis in the church because we refuse to talk about these things.
Yeah.
The second thing I want to say, have any of you ever read the book called Sapiens?
No.
If you haven't read it, I highly recommend it.
Human history book.
It's a fascinating book.
Right.
I forget the name of the author. It's kind of the history of Earth. It's a very widely read book. Let me look up the person who wrote it here. I have it right here on my phone. It's by Yuval Noah Harari. It's called Sapiens. He talks about the development of Homo sapiens, us people. And he points out towards the beginning of his book that there's a misconception we have about the development of Homo sapiens, which is we think like Neanderthal man, Homo erectus, and Homo sapiens kind of lived chronologically, right, subsequent to each other. But he says they weren't. They actually overlapped and coexisted numerous times or throughout history. And he said Homo sapiens, who we are, we were the middle to the lower end of the food chain. We're not very smart, not very fast, not very strong. And if we had, if 10 Homo sapiens had a battle with 10 Neanderthals, then Neanderthals would win. If 50 Homo sapiens had a battle with 50 Neanderthals, then Neanderthals would win. If 100 Homo sapiens had a battle with 100 Neanderthals, then Neanderthals would win. And I forget what year he pointed out, but he said there was one stage in evolution where Homo sapiens developed the ability to imagine. Now, it is impossible to organize, physically impossible to organize more than 100 people without having the ability to imagine. And we developed the ability to imagine. We developed an imagination. And that gave birth to two things. It gave birth to religion, because you can't understand God without an imagination. And it gave birth to politics, because you can't organize more than 100 people without imagination. So all the way back in human history, he's pointing out, there has been an intertwining of religion and politics that came from the same seed, imagination.
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, let me put myself back in Ray's shoes. I'm a Christian because that's who colonized us, right? If I had that sort of understanding and I was in the place of my grandparents in the boarding school, where they are being told, you cannot have your creation story, you cannot have your language, you cannot have your own faith, you have to assimilate and become like white people. I imagine, what if my grandfather had the wherewithal to interrogate the faith at that point and say, okay, let's see, does this work out?
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's what I'm doing. I am writing this book in the mindset of I am the son of boarding school survivors.
Mm-hmm.
And I am interrogating my faith. And what I'm finding is, when I'm looking closely at what these scriptures celebrate, what they say about God, even how they are both similar and different from my own traditional beliefs as our Navajo beliefs, I wish my grandfather would have had the wherewithal to say to the missionaries, I don't like your God. Your God's very violent, very vindictive, treats women like shit, and looks a lot like you do.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Manifest destiny, ethnic cleansing. It was Abraham Lincoln who committed genocide against my people. You're calling the man who did genocide to the Navajo people the greatest president who ever lived.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, your God looks exactly like you do. Or maybe you look exactly like your God. I don't know which came first, the chicken or the egg, but you guys look very similar and none of those are attractive. And so I'm not abandoning my faith. I still identify as a Christian, but I am with this book. I am doing everything I can to look my brothers and sisters in the church in the eye and say, we have to find a way to talk about these things, because if we don't, we're just going to continue to perpetuate these behaviors and these actions over and over and over, and there will be no growth.
Mm-hmm.
There will be no hojon, no balance, no peace, no harmony.
Yeah. What do you have to say to the people for whom that process is maybe too scary or too costly? I mean, the three of us are coming from a circumstance where our church interrogated the racism and homophobia of our church, and that basically killed the church in a spectacular fashion.
What is fascinating about that is how in many ways progressive we were until we turned the mirror on ourselves.
Mm-hmm. And I think more than one of us has at certain points thought, like, was it worth it? Was this whole thing worth it? All the pain that we went through in terms of this, and the loss of the church, and all the grief that went through, was that a worthwhile process? And I don't know if we have a definitive answer yet. Bethany, anything?
Mine Beth is definitive. No, I would, if I could go back in time, I'd just let them white people have it.
It's so hilarious. I mean, I feel that way as a white person. I feel like that's an understandable way to feel. I just want things back the way they were and everybody to be happy. That's the want there.
White people don't actually want people to be happy. White people just want to be comfortable.
Let me be more so. I want to be happy again.
Yeah. White people want to personally be happy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Mark, I feel like I'm really understanding a lot of I'm seeing unsettling truths through a new lens now. Hearing you talk, you know, I think it seems to me like you feel there's a lot of value in this process of interrogation. What do you hope is going to be there on the other side, if there is another side, if there is the other side?
So one of the things I feel very strongly about, right? The reason I'm able to do this, right? If you had told me five, six years ago, I would be asking these questions today,
mm-hmm.
I would have been shocked. If you had told me 10 years ago, I would be asking this question, I would have been like horrified. right? I'm asking questions now that I don't even know how I'm going to conclude the book yet. I'm writing it so I can find an end for myself. I don't know the answer yet. Yeah. That's why I'm writing the book. And one of the things I've noticed, if you remember back in On Selling Truth, if you read the introduction, I talk about one of the most, or the most valuable spiritual discipline I've ever had, which is the discipline of watching the sunrise.
Yeah.
And of how it's one thing when you see it once or twice a year, but watching it day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year, and then decade after decade, it does something incredibly deep in your soul that I wasn't expecting. And so now, right, I mean, I feel like I know Creator, not because of something I read in a book, but because I've watched the sunrise for 25 years. I know something about Creator. And so when I read parts of the scripture, I'm like, yeah, that's not Creator. I don't know who that is. That's not Creator. It looks a lot like you, Dominant Culture Church, but that's not who Creator is. And if you think that, and I tell people this, if you think, so what do we have in the Psalms, right? In the Psalms, we have David and the psalmist asking God to do what to their enemies?
Kill them.
Kill their enemies. We have the psalmist over and over praising God for doing what to their enemies?
Just the same. Kill them.
Killing them. We are being groomed to see violence as love.
Yep.
And the only people who see violence as love are people who are abusive or have been abused.
Yep.
And so I am saying to my church, yeah, that's not what love is. That might be what your book says, but that's not what love is. And that what you're describing in the story is not who Creator is. And this is literally, it's not like I didn't have these questions before, right? But this is the first time in my life I'm not afraid to ask the question.
Yeah.
And it's not because I know the answer. Like, I am well aware these questions could literally crumble the church. But I'm no longer afraid of that because of how well I know Creator now. And so about the same time I started asking these questions in 2020, actually it was in 2021. It was after the campaign was over. And I was thinking through all the stuff and I realized I had fallen out of the habit of watching the sunrise for a while. And I knew I had to get back to it. If you go back on my social media, you'll see going back 20 years, I have pictures. When I lived on the reservation, every morning I take a picture of the sunrise as I stood there. If you go back to 2021 and look at my both my Facebook page and my YouTube channel, I started watching the sunrise again back in early 2021. And I decided, I made the intentional choice, instead of just taking a picture, I was going to live stream it. And the reason I decided to live stream is because one of the things I learned this beforehand, but it was solidified in my campaign, is the United States of America does not want to talk about these foundational issues. It doesn't want to. And the only reason I've been able to ask these questions and look at these things, both in my faith and in my nation, is because of the confidence I have in Creator, which has come from watching the sunrise for 25 years. And so I decided intentionally in 2021 to begin live streaming the sunrises when I watch them.
Yeah, I remember that.
As a way to invite and disciple my nation. If I want my nation to have this conversation, I need to give them the same tools that I used to deal with this uncertainty and chaos. I'm live streaming the sunrise when I watch them. I'm inviting people to join me. I have a massive archive library of sunrises now over the past 3.5 years. So people can go back and watch these sunrises. I want to have this conversation. But I know in our current state, both our nation and the church are not ready to have it. And so as I'm trying to engage it, I'm also trying to give them the tools that I found useful to have these types of dialogues.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's meaningful to me to hear that you have a discipline and a spiritual practice that connects you to God. And because of that, you have the confidence to do this kind of interrogation and that this deconstruction doesn't scare you. It still scares me. So maybe I need to, to observe the sunrise too. do we want to, are we okay leaving it there and going into our last segment?
Yes. All right,
yeah, let's do it. That's great.
The last thing that we like to do is talk about whatever we're into this week. Beth, do you want to kick us off?
Yeah, it is hard for me to think of something that I'm into. I spent all day with my Sword Wars at the capital of Delaware, listening to politicians all day. So my mind is not in the best space to think of the things that I like, but I'll throw something out there. I'm into gummy candy. I gave it up during Lent, and I have enjoyed the last 2 or 3 weeks.
Awesome. Eating any particular gummy candy?
Swedish Fish. Oh, but okay. Today I'm eating Sour Patch Kids, which is like the cousin of Swedish Fish.
Nice. Chris, do you have anything?
Is it okay if I'm into 2 things?
Sure.
The first, the last couple of weeks of there have just been some phenomenons that have been really fun, like the eclipse and the teeniest tiniest earthquake experience here in Philly, which like people are still talking about, like where were you when it happened? Even though it was seriously like where I was sitting, it was like somebody was just rumbling a chair really hard on the floor below me, and then it stopped. So like natural phenomena definitely ranks. The eclipse is really fun to watch. Even though at the moment of the nearest to totality we were going to see, that's when the clouds covered it up.
Yeah.
That was not cool clouds.
Oh, that's right.
Yep.
So uncool. The other thing is the 11th annual Sojourner Truth Walk, which is May 4th. This is a good friend of mine who runs this. This girls' leadership program that sort of culminates in a camp. Camp is definitely part of the experience. Takes young women into the woods to for like really really cool like growth experiences. If girls have been part of this camp over the years, like they graduate into leadership roles, and really like they gain all these skills and confidence and. I'm just like, yeah, this will be my 10th or 11th time doing this walk. I'm really excited to be a part of it.
Awesome. Mark, do you have anything for us?
This is going to sound very weird after this very deep conversation we've had. I'm in the comedy. I'm in the comedy. I am working on a 75-minute presentation that I want to take on a national tour, talking about Abraham Lincoln, who he is, what he did, and not only exposing him as a blatant, unapologetic, self-proclaimed white supremacist, but also one of the most genocidal presidents in our nation's history. And I want to tell that story with a comedic thread going through it.
Okay. The fact that you said that and then added that it was going to be comedic is comedic to me.
Yeah. So I gave my first presentation last week in Portland in front of an invite-only audience so I could get feedback. It didn't go, I knew it was going to be bad, but it was bad. But I got some tremendous feedback. And I feel like, and I even some of the feedback I got is I'm close. I'm not there yet. No, I didn't have a lot of laughter in the presentation. And again, but I have some threads that I can weave through it. And I'm going to do my best to do that. So I am actually really into comedy right now. I'm studying some different comedians. I'm trying to write some jokes. I'm even thinking about doing some 10-minute bits at some comedy clubs around so I can just get used to telling jokes in front of an audience. So yeah, that's what I'm into right now. I'm going to become a student of comedy for the next several months.
Where can we see Mark Charles do his next comedy bit?
I don't have it scheduled yet. I have to get more material written, and I have to figure out how I'm going to weave it through. But once I have it, I need to get in front of an audience.
Yeah.
See, the challenge is right. These conversations go really deep. If I don't get people laughing in the beginning, I can't get them laughing later.
Mm-mm. Right.
No.
And so I have to start with like a 10 to 15 minute bit that introduces what I'm doing, but does it in a way that gives people both A, permission to laugh, and B, the permission to cry, and C, the permission to know we're going to take this deep at various times.
Awesome.
And so anyway, so I have a lot of work ahead of me, but I have not been this excited about trying to figure something out since my 2020 campaign.
Awesome.
And I am really looking forward to seeing how I can bring this together.
Yeah.
That's great. So are we. I'm into my rabbit Zeke. He's been doing this thing every morning where after his breakfast, he'll follow me into the kitchen and ask for more vegetables from the fridge. And I just can't say no. He's just adorable. So I'm into Zeke this week.
Zeke week.
Mark, thank you so much for being with us here. This was really meaningful.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Bethany, Mark, Andrew, Chris, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate all of you. I'm sorry if I didn't get to answer all your questions, but... if people want to...
I mean, like, all the questions we thought we were going to ask, well, I don't think we asked a single one of those.
Just went out the window. It's a completely different direction.
Can I ask you something now? Just, I'd love to hear this from each of you, if I could just ask. Yeah. I know I gave you a lot of information, some of it probably overwhelming. I'm curious just to hear how you heard what I've said.
We should be asking more questions. And the things... You have to trust your humanity, and the things that feel funny about the Bible, you have every right to interrogate and ask more questions about God. And it doesn't mean you're any less a person of faith. It means that I just hear you wrestling with it, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's not an indictment of your faith. It's okay to interrogate.
Definitely what's new for me. What's new for me is interrogating the source material, right? Mm-hmm. Like when Mark, when you talked about the doctrine of discovery, like, yeah, I was like, of course, like, yeah, this country's racist. Like, oh, right. And the principles that founded this country come from like racist ideas from Christianity. Yeah. But to begin to disassemble the foundational documents of faith versus the foundational documents of nation building. Well, that's a whole different exercise. And it is challenging my ideas like of what's possible. So Beth, I appreciate that, that perspective, like, and really the one you offered as well, Mark, like when the words don't line up with what you see and what you know to be true in yourself, like you can still have a foundation and a conversation with the one who made you.
Mm-hmm.
That's still on the table.
I was observing in myself a pretty interesting reaction, which is I really wanted to get to the hope. I was hearing you deconstruct everything, and I wanted you to get to the, but this is why, you know, because I'm always trying to do that. I feel like I do that with this podcast. You know, the last third is always like, here is how we bring it around and make it somewhat uplifting.
Right.
But I think it's very important to pay attention to that discomfort, and it's okay to live in it. And I think, honestly, a lot of people a lot of Christians especially probably need to learn that that discomfort is okay. Yeah. Maybe it can be holy even, and there won't be answers. Not easy ones. So I think that's a lesson that I need to learn, and I appreciate you being here, Mark, to help teach that.
Yeah.
Mark, where else can we find you and your stuff?
Yeah, so you can find me. I'm online, Wireless Hogan to my handle on most social media platforms. I'm most active on Facebook and Instagram and YouTube. I have my own podcast called My Second Cup of Coffee, which I stream normally twice a week. I stream it live on my Facebook page and on my YouTube channel. And I then upload it to my the podcast website. So any place you get your podcast, you can download it there.
Nice.
Spotify, Apple, all the other ones. I'm doing that. I'm the best way that people can follow me and help me in the work I'm doing is to subscribe to me on Patreon. I have several tiers there. One of the most popular tiers is my middle tier. It's my $10 tier, where once a month I call it my Ask Questions session, and I just kind of have an open dialogue with my Patreon subscribers, and they ask questions about the books I'm reading, or the books I'm writing, or things I've said, or things going on. I also have a level of my Patreon called Decolonizing Faith. And every month I go through content from the book I'm writing. I'm an extrovert, so I can't just sit down and ponder things and then write them out. I have to talk about them ahead of time to get them more clear in my brain. Mm-hmm. And so I'm using my Patreon site. So people subscribe to that level and they can be a part of that dialogue as I'm wrestling through some of these things. And yeah, it's a definite process. At times it's challenging, confusing, but it's really exciting. I love doing it. So if you go to my website, wirelesshogan.com, people can buy signed copies of my book. I sell them there. I also do what's called my book study special, where if a group orders 10 copies of my book, 10 signed copies from my website, I will give their book study a free virtual 45-minute Q&A at some point over the next year that they can schedule with me so they can have a Q&A with me about the book they're reading through. So, yeah, those are the things I'm most excited about that I'm working on. That's how people can reach me. From my website, wirelesshogan.com, you'll get links to all my social media spots on there, too. You can find me there, too.
Yeah. Special thanks to Jared Selby, who does our theme song. Tess Patino is our producer and social media goddess. And Amy Young does our website.
I almost jumped the gun, sorry. And we want to hear from y'all. We haven't heard from y'all in a while. So make sure you go to our podcast, colorcorrectionpodcast.com, and drop us a line, because we want to hear about you following Jesus, following your faith, deconstructing your faith for sure.
Interrogating your faith.
Yeah, we want to hear it all. So drop us a line on colorcorrectionpodcast.com. And with that, stay Black, Little Mermaid. Get the line. Is it see you later? No, it's stay Black, Little Mermaid. I am tired. Stay Black, Little Mermaid. You're messy.
Yeah. Wow.
I definitely almost said see you later, Little Mermaid.
Well,
and with that, stay Black, Little Mermaid.